freedom is a word often heard today. But if you want to keep it, there's a price to pay. Each generation's gotta win it anew, 'cause it's not something handed down to you.
Freedom isn't free.
A general by the name of George, with a small band of men at Valley Forge, left the comfort of home for the cold and ice. They won independence 'cause he paid the price.
Freedom isn't free. Freedom isn't free. You gotta pay a price.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Big Pharma, Market Failure, on Friday, June 9th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Corporate CEO Richard Master will speak with his new documentary, which focuses on the dynamics behind the escalating cost of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. and the impact of soaring healthcare costs on U.S. businesses, working families, and our overall economy. The screening will be followed by comments and Q&A session with Dr. Richard Masters. Again, that's Big Pharma Market Failure on Friday, June 9th at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO. It's 9:01 and a half. And here's what we have coming up for you during our public affairs lineup for this morning. First, it's The Politics of Living, the author of Living Curiously, How to Use Curiosity to Be Remarkable and Do Good Stuff. The Q Center's recent show, How Do You See Peace? Plus Appropriation versus Appreciation of First Nations Traditions. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. And then at 10:15, we got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, the Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. You know, if you hear my voice, I can't answer the phone. So call again when I stop talking. Thank you. And at 11, thank you, KBOO members, also for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. And here we go with The Politics of Living.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchek. Every part of our lives is filled with politics, whether it's food, relationships, work, or just living. Politics are right there. They're in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the music we listen to. On today's show, we meet Cindy Surrendorf. She's the executive director of the Charles Surrendorf II Art Foundation and daughter of the nonprofit's namesake. We'll also take a virtual tour of the Squamish-Lowaat Cultural Center in British Columbia. And musician Deborah Giannini returns with a performance of an Aeneas Mitchell song. But first, not too long ago, I invited local author Becky Saltzman into the KBOO studios to talk about her most recent book, Living Curiously, How to Use Curiosity to Be Remarkable and Do Good Stuff. So let's jump right into the method.
Okay.
What are the five or six points of the method? And then we'll kind of jump into each one a little bit.
Okay. So the first two are kind of an internal inquiry using curiosity. And all of this is based on the science of curiosity and decades of research and interviews and interaction. So it's not just something made up. It's something that I found that remarkable people actually do using curiosity.
And I want to add, you are a behavior scientist.
That's my background.
That's your background.
Yeah, that is my background.
Okay.
And so I've been studying curiosity for decades. So the first two steps of the method, the first step of the method is start with what you're not, and the second step is dumpster dive your life. And these are internal inquiry challenges using curiosity. And the second kind of chunk are the third and fourth step, which is cross-pollinate, which I call collide with fear-inducing and intrigue-inducing people and places, again, using curiosity, and then find uncommon commonalities. And that is really based in persuasion science. And then the fifth step in the method is BLAST, which is blunder, learn, accumulate successes, and try again. And those are based on a couple of interesting conundrum as well.
So let's go in a little bit more deeply into each part of the methods. Mm-hmm. Let's just be linear about it, right? Because I think you do talk about the process is a process. So
we're gonna
stay with the process. And so, you know, start with what you're not, dumpster dive your life. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so starting with what you're not is based on a very interesting fact that we become very uncomfortable not only knowing what we don't know, but knowing that we don't know. And that discomfort makes it hard for us to know when we're wrong. And it creates a sneaky problem, which is when we are wrong, it feels suspiciously like being right, because when we're wrong, we think we're right. And so becoming uncomfortable with being wrong allows us to challenge assumptions of being right. And that's the first step in kind of tackling cognitive biases, for lack of a smoother word.
So being open mm-hmm. to the possibility more often than not you're wrong, and that's okay. I mean, just being open to that, and then being self-judgmental, mm-hmm. but being like, oh, trying to understand what's underneath that.
Right. So a friend of mine asked me about judging compassionately, which is one of the most important kinds of features of the first step of the method, right? And she says, well, does judging compassionately make you, you know, less judgmental? And I had to think about that for a minute, and I really thought, no, it doesn't make you less judgmental. It makes you more accurate in your judgments.
Okay.
And to me, that might be, from an insight standpoint, a more important goal. And what I found in these people who use curiosity in a very strategic way to do remarkable things, it turned out that that was a key distinction for them as well.
Can you cite an example?
Yeah. So for an example, when I remember we had this garage sale once, and this woman came in who, by pretty much every measure, was unhinged. She was disheveled. She was weird. She was a little scary, inappropriate, and she came into this garage sale and she asked to go inside the house. Mm. And I was just a teenager, and I remember this so well. And she, my mother, who was not, you know, the most trusting, naive, it's not like she was some compassionate Mother Teresa, but there was something about this woman that she was curious about and judged her differently, I would argue more accurately. She gave the woman orange juice, and it turns out that the woman was heading toward a diabetic coma. She wasn't unhinged at all. She was highly diabetic, going into ketosis, and the orange juice just snapped her out of it. And, you know, I remember my mother explaining that that is the difference between just being compassionate and judging compassionately.
It's just pausing and being thoughtful and asking the questions.
Yeah, I said, how did you know? She says, I was curious.
And not being, but, you know, it's not assumptions, right? Mm-hmm. Conclusions.
Busting assumptions.
Excellent. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, dumpster diving.
Yes.
That brings up a variety of images. Why that term? And let's talk a little bit about that.
So many things that we try to impress people with are obvious and seemingly trying to be impressive, right? I mean, whether it's degrees, whether it's awards, whether it's jobs. And then we talk a lot about authenticity, and it's kind of a word that's bandied about, you know. And what does it mean? Well, everything indicates with these remarkable people and in the science of branding and all of this and using curiosity, everything indicates that it is really the things, the stories, the early conversations and early experiences from the dumpster of our lives, things that we've dismissed as not impressive or mundane to us, that really seem interesting to other people. And that's how we connect. So, for example, let's say I have, you know, a PhD in something, and I tell you I have a PhD in something, and that's all fine and good, but there's no context for it. But if I tell you, you know, when I was 6 years old, my parents cut my hair, dressed me as a boy, and dragged me to the first of hundreds of auctions so I could learn the lost art of selling from the master persuader auctioneers, you might start saying, interesting, your knowledge in persuasion science has a more interesting route. And we all have these stories, and they're free.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're either sometimes painful, sometimes embarrassing, sometimes not impressive, but they're there, and they are how we connect with others. And being curious about that is very important.
So at this point, these first two steps, it's an inner excavation.
Yes. Yeah, it's really elevating curiosity. And dumpster diving, you really have to elevate curiosity, particularly if you're with...
You don't know what's in there.
Yeah, well, or you've dismissed it,
yeah.
Or you don't think it's impressive because it's something stupid. It's a simple story, a simple conversation. You might not even know why it makes sense. But when you excavate it and share it, it starts to form, and the reason for its excavation becomes clear. So,
and it's, you know, part of the whole art of storytelling.
Yeah.
And all of that. So
yeah.
The next thing, I think there's my favorite step, is cross-pollinate.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that.
As a podcaster interviewing people, I can only imagine. Yes. And it's interesting. The cross-pollinating is, in my opinion, the most fun step because, you know, colliding with fear-inducing and intrigue-inducing people and places. And I make a distinction between fear and phobia. This is like an eyebrow-plucking level of, you know, I'm fearful that it's going to hurt my, you know, like it's not supposed to be, you know, torturous, right? But so often we don't know how to meet interesting people. We might identify someone and say, wow, wouldn't it be cool if I could meet so-and-so? Or I'm interested in learning more about Wiccans or witches or radio, for mm-hmm. example. And yet we don't really have, you know, when we're in fourth grade, we can come in and say, hey, I'm working on a school project. Can I have a tour of the radio station? But we don't have that ability as adults to kind of get the behind the scenes look. Telling people that you're working on a Living Curiously project is kind of, you know,
It's the pass.
It's the backstage pass.
Yeah.
And you can always be working on a Living Curiously project. So those kinds of experiences were the most fun in terms of creating and exploring and excavating the method.
So it was a lot of the connecting of dots of
mm-hmm.
sorts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and then connecting the dots. So mm-hmm. taking completely unrelated things and zigzagging them into meaning. But it starts with connecting with fear-inducing and intrigue-inducing people and places. It's stepping a little outside your comfort
zone. That does take a little bit of chutzpah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a word? Chutzpah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Chutzpah. You can
have to add that little kick to it. So find uncommon commonalities.
Mm-hmm.
And I love on page 115 and 116 a whole list of uncommon examples. And my question was, which I wrote here, was, are these real or did you take some? I mean, did you talk to people? Are some of these your things, like sports? You both competed for an Olympic spot in swimming. Did you do that?
No, I did not compete for. I could have, but no one would have been aware of it.
Because these are like, do you both like spicy grasshoppers and mole sauce?
Yeah, I mean, that one is.
That
actually
is.
I did find someone, you know, and even as simple as I was with I don't like chocolate.
Yeah.
And I was speaking to a group of people and I said, how many people don't like chocolate? And one person raised their hand. And afterwards, she came up and we were just talking. We were just talking trash about chocolate.
How can you be? We won't do that here. No.
That's not. Yeah, that, we don't have that uncommon commonality, I guess.
Yeah. Wow, these are really fabulous. I'm not going to recite them all. You're going to have to buy the book because they're pretty cool. Okay, so then we have the final step five, blast. Blunder, learn, accumulate successes, try again. So let's talk about that.
Well, it's really finding, you know, this whole thing of failure is kind of a buzz phrase. Fail forward, fail sideways, fail fast, fail slow. Quitters never quit. I mean, you know, quit. The easiest thing to do is to quit. Well, I mean, try telling that to me with a bowl of chips and salsa and a pitcher of margaritas in front of me, the easiest thing to do to quit. These are platitudes, right?
Yeah, right.
And yet, curiously, again, excavating your supposed blunders for successes is critical. And sometimes time is the thumb on the scale. So if you measure the success of a book launch, you know, the day before the book launch, it's going to be, that's the wrong time to measure it. If you are creating any kind of project, and particularly one where you're really trying to create and inspire beneficial change, right? Which is the purpose of the Living Curiously, purpose of Living Curiously, purpose of the book. If you're trying to do that, the time to measure that, or you're starting any endeavor, is critical. And that's where the two conundrum come in that are involved in the blast. The quit-fail conundrum.
Okay.
When is quitting failure, and when is failing to quit failure?
Interesting, right? To know when to stop or not stop.
Right. And how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And there's very specific things using curiosity. And this is what people, this was a huge distinction in some of these remarkable people. They understood the difference between sunk costs and opportunity costs. And time again, these people would talk about this, and they may not use the term, but they got it. And I was thinking, you know, time and time again, it's like the common, that was the uncommon commonality in these remarkable people that I interviewed.
Okay.
You know.
Excellent. So I have a question. I'm sure in your studies of long ago, but living life in that constant life study, you're hearing, I'm sure, a lot about growth mindset and fixed mindset.
Carol Dweck, yeah.
How does that fit into this conversation? Is there a place for that stuff, that mindset stuff?
There is a lot of, so curiosity has been an ingredient in a lot of kinds of other either trendy or truly scientific things like creativity, mindfulness, growth mindset, all of that. I would like to make it its own meal because I think it's somewhat different, but it definitely is an element because you have to be curious about your limitations. It starts with curiosity when you're looking at the growth versus fixed mindset, right? But it's not the same, but it's an I would say it's an ingredient. Just like I think it's an ingredient in creativity. I think curiosity gives creativity its relevance. So if you're doing something, some art project that's just fun for you versus you're a graphic designer doing something for a bigger, kind of not a bigger, but an actual purpose other than just creating art. So it is an ingredient in the growth mindset, but it's not synonymous with.
Gotcha. So when you were going through living this, and then documenting it.
Yes.
You provide exercises. You encourage people to experiment, right? That's all part of this process.
Yes.
What was the most challenging exercise or experiment that you had to do?
Okay. So I had, there were some interesting ones. Some of them involved, you know, spelunking in caves when I am severely claustrophobic and trying to understand hunger, going on kind of long fasts and trying to explore hunger from curiosity. But the most difficult of all was when I went to the largest Pray the Gay Away convention in the country. And trying to go there, elevating curiosity ahead of criticism, right, ahead of judgment, certainly ahead of fear, and ahead of complacency, ahead of being complacent that I know this is, I know what I know about this and my opinion is right, which is a form of complacency, but actually trying to extract insights when I have strong opinions, that was probably the hardest time I spent. And listening to some of these people whose opinions were so different from my own and trying to do that from a place of curiosity, that was the hardest thing I've ever done testing this.
I'm just trying to put myself in that moment with
and
you.
And alone.
So there's courage on so many levels.
Otherwise, I would have probably had someone that, you know, I don't want to wink and, you know, make it all kitschy.
Right. And so when you were talking to folks at that event, I mean, did you say, oh, I'm writing a book?
But
no. You were just there. Hey, I'm just curious about this.
I didn't tell them. They didn't ask.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Have your friends and families used the method? Have they reported back?
Yeah.
And what kind of reports back have you gotten?
So my sister said, my sister and I have traveled a lot. We've done these kind of curiosity quests, right? And she says that the whole idea of living curiously, not just the method, but just the concept of elevating curiosity and then kind of putting curiosity first, right? That has changed her life dramatically. So she said not only the insights and her adventures when she travels are just supersized, right? She meets new people. She's made more connections for work, whatever. And she's really the first one that – she's been my first victim, I would say, because a lot of this, you know, we've done a lot of traveling together. And I'll say, okay, now I got to go work on some things. And I'll say, you know, we're in a bar or we're there to meet someone specifically. So, yeah, absolutely. And my kids, I would say that my youngest son learning about this method probably helped save the life of my oldest son when we were dealing with his cancer. And that was as simple as calling me out, calling BS on me when I was trying to cancel a second opinion because the first opinion gave me so much comfort.
Mm.
And then saying, you know, wait a minute, what is, you told me that, you know, being curious about a second opinion, and you told me that when you're stressed, it's not time to make decisions, and you told me that, you know, you need to be more curious, and that probably, and, you know, it's a little dramatic to say, but I think if you know, people familiar with this situation might acknowledge that sharing Living Curiously with at least my family and friends has had profound effects.
How old was he at that time?
My son?
The young, yeah.
So the Barkley was 17, so Dane was 15.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
14 maybe.
That's an incredible story.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Just calling his mother out. He enjoyed correcting his mom, but I, you know, and I probably didn't at the time. But in hindsight, that was one time you can contradict your mother.
That's right. Children are here to teach us as well.
Yeah,
right?
Well, whatever, yeah.
That's what I tell myself when my 12-year-old Lila is sassing me. She's teaching me something here.
Yeah,
teaching me something.
Sass mouth.
I loved your questions in the book. You have like I think I mentioned earlier, you know, this hodgepodge of questions. And like, for instance, you know, can you buy a tractor with a cigar?
Yeah.
Where did that kind of stuff come from? I mean, did you extrapolate that from hearing people's stories, or was it something at the front end of your exploration?
Okay, that's a good question, because it would be a little bit cheating to say that it's at the front end, right? But it probably is somewhat true, if I'm totally honest, because those are the kinds of questions that I was subjected to. You know, I grew up in a kind of a weird environment with these being dragged to all these auctions. And it was like I lived in a cabinet of curiosities.
So that was you?
That was me.
That was me.
So I kind of conflated two, a couple of things just to make a point because I just, you know, but that was me. So that really did happen. I come from a family of auctioneers. And when I say auctioneers, I mean like industrial auctions and art auctions and not cattle, but, you know, so my dad was bringing home crazy things and things that were, you know, strange and unusual, and tractors and all of this, you know, machines and grease. And so I was quizzed. And oftentimes there's a subtle subtext, you know, within auctions, because there's people bidding for hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And whether it's art or a big tractor or crane or something, and there's competition, right? You might have your competition there. So there's little ways and little micro expressions and little things and little tricks that certain bidders are known for. And one of them in the book I talk about was a guy with a cigar, and he would tip his cigar up and down ever so slightly because he didn't want his competitors to see him bidding. Or he was trying to bid up his competitors so they would pay too much for something, you know. I mean, so there's little things. So those kinds of questions I grew up with. So I tried to then bring some of those questions to some of the people that I was interviewing.
That was Becky Saltzman, author of Living Curiously, How to Use Curiosity to Be Remarkable and Do Good Stuff. You can learn more about Becky and all of her books by visiting her website, BeckySaltzman.com, and that's Becky with an I. Next, contributing producers Tave Fache-Drake and Brian Delaney spoke with Josh Anderson of the Squamish-Lillooet Cultural Center in British Columbia. They talked about First Nations traditional culture, respect for all living things, and appropriation versus appreciation.
In the United States, we have different Native American tribes. In Canada, they have different nations. I had a great opportunity to go up to Whistler, British Columbia, and bring my mother and my daughters along for a trip to the Squamish-Lillooet Cultural Center. Their vision is to share their cultural knowledge to inspire understanding and respect among all people. I was really happy to call up there and get Josh to have a phone conversation with us. Josh, are you there?
I'm here, Tave.
All right, great. I was wondering if you would introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, sure. My name is Josh Anderson. I am from the Lillooet Nation. One of the things is that I was originally born and raised in the city, in Vancouver, BC, before I was going into grade two. And then my mom moved us home to Mount Currie.
How large is your nation?
About 2,700 nation members altogether, a really tight-knit community. We recognize the entire traditional territory as Lillooet, but where our village or town is, it's called Mount Currie.
Tell us a little bit about what you do.
I am currently the cultural delivery leader here at the Squamish-Lillooet Cultural Center. We officially opened back in summer of 2008, and I've been here since the beginning. What I do is I have cultural ambassadors that provide the guest experience and guided tours on a day-to-day basis. I help to manage our cultural performance team that do our traditional drumming and singing for any dignitaries or groups that are coming in to visit in our territories here in Whistler.
I noticed when we were emailing at the bottom of your sign-off, S-I-K, S-I-K. What does that mean?
That is my traditional name, Sheik Sheik. And it means powerful ground. And it was a name that was passed down to me from my late uncle. I believe I was 11. It's something that will stay within the family.
And is that like a coming of age that children around that age get a traditional name?
It's quite different for everyone. My daughters were gifted their traditional names right away from one of our elders because he actually dreamt of our daughter's names.
Oh, I love it.
Quite amazing.
Wow.
We watched your introductory video. Could you elaborate on what you find in nature?
So, Brian, one of the ones is stinging nettle.
We know it well.
We actually just got finished making a soup with stinging nettle and dandelion greens.
Oh, that's awesome. They actually use nettle leaves in a bath. Of course, that puts you in kind of like a stinging nettle soup.
Oh,
we like that.
That's one of the ways to cure aches and pains.
Sure.
There's a couple of different salves that we actually make and create. One of them is Devil's Club. It's the really sharp, prickly bush. They actually have to dig into the land a little bit, and it's more of the root of the Devil's Club. You kind of have to shave it off. We call it 101 uses. It's good for rashes or abrasions, arthritis.
Are there traditional soups that you eat?
We have salmon egg. We call it kuna in our language. We have land soup. That is like wind-dried salmon soup. We have tsiit. That's a deer meat.
How did you say that again?
Tsiit, spelled T-S-I-7. So many different natural soups and stews we get from our animals or from our waters.
Are you teaching your daughters how to hunt or forage?
It's quite amazing because their kuka, their grandma, and their great-grandma, a wife's grandma, both are herbologists within the nation. So they know which plants to go and harvest at a certain time of year to create certain medicines.
Like that salve you were talking about.
Yeah. And then my mom is more of the craft person. She does a lot of the cedar bark weavings, like my traditional cedar bark headdress that I wear, or I get spoiled by my mom. I usually get a new one for my birthday. One of my passions was drumming and singing, something that I picked up right away at a very young age, hearing some of my uncles. And then by the time I was 8 years old, I was gifted my first hand drum by my uncle. It was handmade, going all the way down to the frame and the hide. And I was like, wow. When I made my first traditional drum, it was back in junior high school. It was quite a small 10-inch drum. I gifted that to my baby sister. So I've made drums for my sisters. I've made for my wife and my daughters. So, funny story, my drum that I have now, originally the deer hide that I had was a white-tailed deer. I was starting the process of creating my drum, so I had the hide soaking. I made the mistake of leaving the hide not in an enclosed area, but outside, unprotected. So the next day, a bear drug off the hide.
Oh my gosh.
I had to get another hide. So I had the hide soaking for a few days. My wife's uncle has given me pointers. Josh, you will know when the hide is ready, and you can easily pluck the fur off the hide. And when it comes out real easy, that's when you know that it's ready. That was the first time I got to defur and deflesh a hide on my own. And he's like, make sure that you are absolutely wearing all of the clothes, all the way down to your shoes, that you're going to throw away after when you're done. My wife, bless her, she came out with a change of clothes and a garbage bag.
You utilized every portion of the deer, whether it be making a drum, whether it be eating it as a soup, making clothing out of it. And that seems to be the case today as well.
Most definitely. Yeah. Something that I'm looking forward to this summer is having the ability to do everything from scratch, you know, just like how I did my hand drum, creating the buckskin leather that we wear for our traditional clothing. That process takes a lot longer.
It was mentioned at the cultural center that you have drums and each person can find their own beat. I'm wondering, is that a metaphor for life as well as music?
One of the things with that, Tave, they say that the drum beat is our heartbeat. It's the heartbeat of our people going into the drum. A lot of the songs have different meaning, from celebrations and honoring of certain animals. Like when we do have honored guests, family, friends, you know, that come through the center, we do traditionally a welcome song. That was one of the things from some of our ancestors from years ago, when one of our members went to go meet guests and sang them the song to welcome them into our territory. The other part of it is when we are at home, if we're doing celebration, we do share many different types of songs. When we have certain celebrations going on, we could have anywhere between 50 to 100 different drummers and singers out on the floor at the same time. That's usually when it sounds the most amazing, with everyone drumming and singing with each other. A lot of the traditional songs are songs of the land. We have a bear song. The bear signifies a family member. Going back to the beginning, our people originally were taught a lot from the bear naturally, on how the bear did its gathering, on how he prepared for hibernation for the long winters that we had. The bear was a great teacher in a way.
Fantastic.
Well, you did give him your first deer.
Yeah, that's all they get. We have a deer song that's a little bit more sacred in Lilt-Let, so it's not shared as often. We have a groundhog song, that song we call the Whistler song. In Whistler, we had the majority of the marmot or the groundhog.
And Josh, so what would be your definition of sustainability?
This is going by the definition of my people, is that we have one traditional saying, and we call it kulchan. And that means we only take what we need. And that's one of the things that we go by as a nation. It definitely speaks of how our people lived for hundreds of thousands of years and how we took care of the land, and in return, the land really took care of us. We're really quite fortunate. I have my two baby daughters, and just really looking forward to teaching them our way of life. They've done a lot already. They're a part of our Lilt-Let language immersion program within our school.
How many people speak the Lilt-Let language still?
We probably have about 3% of fluent speakers left, but we do have a lot of people that are either moderate or beginner speakers, and that's pretty much the vital piece for our nation. Because realistically, without our traditional language, I would say that technically we wouldn't have a culture.
Our world right now needs everybody to really care for the earth. Sort of our future, in a way, is looking back at our past. How can people follow your good example and do so respectfully, so that it can be seen as a way of appreciation and saving our earth and not as an appropriation?
You know, I feel that is a really good question, Tave. Because through tough times, through fighting times, we've had a lot of non-Native friends that stood side by side with us. I know for a lot of people, they are fascinated with the type of work that our people do. know, being here at the center, we teach everybody on a day-to-day basis about our customs. And that goes all the way down to making buckskin leather medicine bag pouch. We teach people how to make hand drums, dream catchers. You know, all in all, there are a lot of people taking that extra step, learning different customs or arts and crafts. I guess it is up to the individual themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really does need to take the initiative of trying to do what's right. You know, I think our people would be willing to help. It comes down to individuals wanting to do that and their willingness mm-hmm. to learn. Because we know at the end of the day, it's not going to be the same. It's going to be something different. Kind of a difficult question, kind of open-ended, but, you know, we're not really sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the work you do in the world.
Thank you.
I guess lastly, what advice would you have for any of our listeners as far as caring for the earth or living a sustainable life?
I would have to say when you go out and you breathe the fresh air of nature, appreciate and be grateful for the surroundings that you do have. The gifts are naturally there. Everything from the natural waters, the trees that stand tall, that provide the fresh air. Enjoy it, respect it, and be thankful that you have the beautiful land.
Thank you for that, Josh.
Thank you very much, Brian, Tave, for the phone call. It's been a privilege talking to you. It felt like I was doing a guided tour of the phone.
Yeah.
It was a huge treat having you, and I really appreciate your taking the time and the consideration to have this wonderful conversation with us.
And I look forward to visiting your center, too.
Yeah, you don't come up. I know we're just up the road from you guys down in Portland.
Yay.
All right, guys, take care.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks to Tave and Brian for sharing a portion of their conversation with Josh Anderson of the Squamish Lowoc Cultural Center with us today. Now, you can hear the entire interview by listening to Tave's podcast on the KBOO website. Just search for Peace, Love, and Soup. Next up, How Do You See Peace? It was a recent art show at the Q Center, and it's going to continue to live on throughout the 2017-2018 school year as part of Cindy Surendorf's work with Oregon Public Schools. Contributor Inessa Anderson and Cindy met to talk about some of the many community issues that are dividing our city, our country, and how to best to bridge those gaps with others who may be different from ourselves and work against cynicism. Their conversation begins with a great backstory on Cindy's artist father, Charles Surendorf II.
In his journeys, he was lucky enough to do cartooning with Walt Disney. And during that time, they were drawing Mickey Mouse in frame by frame by frame. So Walt Disney came to him once and said, "You're too much of a good artist to be stuck here just drawing panels. How about if I send you out to California because I'm going to open up a studio there?" It was pretty incredible, but my father was always a radical and didn't believe in mass production.
Mm.
And he thought artists who did mass production were selling themselves short. And he actually fell in love with art at such a young age and radicalism that he started seeing the world through his art. Mm-hmm. And so he went to Washington, D.C. on his way to California and started the first open-air art show. And that's when the Depression hit. And so he had, you know, a couple quarters in his pocket and decided that he needed support. So at that time, Roosevelt was signing up people for the WPA, the Arts Project, and a lot of people went to work in construction, but he went to work in their propaganda art part, and they were designing murals for libraries, but he ended up doing a mural in Indiana that actually burned down to the ground, so there's no no other than a letter from the government saying, thank you for painting that mural. But what was incredible was working with the Roosevelt team is they saw his talent, and they needed propaganda posters to encourage people not to burn up their rubber, to not to waste nylons, to pinch
pennies. They had to get the word out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so he did these incredible graphics for the government, and at the same time realized that the government was just as crooked as could be.
Nothing's changed.
And so he actually started doing some propaganda artwork of his own. And the government liked it for some reason because it said something that was contrary to what they were trying to preach, but at the same time, it gave the other voice.
Mm-hmm.
So they commissioned him to do 28 prints of each block that he had made. And they took the ones that he went with Dorothea Lange across to the Dust Bowl, and he created his own Dust Bowl by carving in linoleum block print and then pressing it on rice paper. And
so you established the Charles F. Sarendorf II Art Foundation.
That's correct. I established it in 2010, and I did it because at that time we were in another depression and recession.
And right, from 2008 and on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I lost my job to 37-year-olds. And at that time, I was well into my late 50s. And I saw my dad's art, and it just hit my heart and said, wait a minute, this is the same discrimination he went through from the state of California when he was too old to be representing the art pack in Northern California anymore. And so they wanted to evict him from his art gallery and bring in young people. And I felt that sensation, and I realized, okay, history is repeating itself. How can I show the world that history is repeating itself? How can I draw in a way to show students that this is what happened, this is the consequences, and now this is happening again, here are the results? But then I thought, I'm being cynical, so how do I not be cynical? So I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask the kids to identify the problems, such as starvation, such as homelessness, such as bullying, such as race discrimination, and create a block print of a cure for it or a fix for it or something that would represent a positive note instead of a negative note, because everybody thinks propaganda is a negative note against normal life. And normal life is having different social classes.
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be, in my lifetime at least, we didn't put people down as much as I grew up. I was part of the hippie era. I was part of the peace and love and the music era.
You know, that's when I learned all my feminist attitudes. It's not like I had to evolve to them. It was simply the conversation. Environment was the conversation of the 70s and into the 80s, and to kind of reboot those conversations, don't you?
Absolutely. And I think women are the best to reboot that, because women are nurturing by nature.
Mm-hmm.
Women want to fix things. Women want to see peace versus hate. And I'm not saying all women.
Right. And I think that, too, that ageism thing that, you know, you go into schools to present these programs and you show them what's gone on before and you show an option, you know, in their lives down the road. Because ageism just keeps on rearing its ugly head.
A lot of these students have had their parents fired because of ageism.
Right, but it's easy to fall prey to that, and unless you get taught that at some earlier age and stage that you see how life goes and what the options are and what you can do. Cindy, you're very much a part of the Q Center, and
yes.
I wanted you to tell me a little bit about it and what it does and how it supports our community and the people that are part of it.
Well, the Q Center is this amazing entity of our LGBTQ plus and ally community. It's not just about being gay or lesbian or transgender.
I saw this acronym called GLBTQA.
GLBTQA was how it first was said because of man. They wanted it to be the gay lesbian.
The gay lesbian and thing. Then and then the bi, and then the transgender, and the queer. And then the A?
A is ally, but now it's asexual. There's so much about gender identity right now that my generation is just kind of going, wow. But the neat thing about Q Center is they're keeping up with generation. They just opened up a full transgender health area for people to come in who
are transgender. This is over on Mississippi.
They are they have 6 rooms that they use to facilitate meetings, like the trans men meeting, the trans women meeting. The what I'm involved of is called Encouraging Respect for Aging.
Are elders
forgotten, especially in the LGBTQ world? So many of them are in the closet still.
Because in some cultures, like when I think of Japan, and I think how revered the elders are.
And Hawaii. We had a trans woman come over and speak to one of our student groups, and she was saying back in the original Hawaiian culture, the transgender people were respected to the ultimate. I mean, they were like goddesses and gods.
Like way long ago.
Back in history. Yes.
That's so interesting.
And quote unquote, the white man came and changed it all again.
Yeah. So that's the work of the Q Center. Very, very important work.
Very important.
For elders, for the young, for those who maybe have not come out of the closet, for the transgenders, they're all in our community.
Right. And all of them. There are so many people that need the Q Center.
Yeah.
And Justin and Stacy are the co-executors there, and they have done such a great job bringing in the entire community and turning it into a resource area. They have the largest LGBTQ library in the whole state of Oregon and California.
That's amazing. That's amazing. How do you see Peace, the art show that just finished out? Your imperative continues throughout the next year. And, you know, my first thought was when we had the elections and all this language is flying, this really dark language, scary language, that we need art, like Toni Morrison said. We need art more than ever to fight against a door of oppression that seems to have been flung wide open.
Absolutely. And I say you couldn't say it better than that. What I found right out of November is I jumped into the fire with all the teachers immediately and all the health professionals.
And you go into schools.
I go into high schools. But that's changing now. And that's why I did this on Peace, because we are realizing that the attack now is starting in kindergarten. And that overwhelmed me.
And what do you mean by that?
By the fact that they're brainwashing our young people to believe in privilege, in privilege of cultural privilege, and you know, and I hate to use this word because it's so ugly, but white supremacy has been the follower of our last election. They seem to want to use him as the reason why they're standing up saying you can't be gay, you can't be sick, you can't be elder, because we're so great. And that goes back to the fear factor. People are not finding their inner peace. People are not going to their inner peace anymore since November. They're freaking out. They're saying, what if, what if, what if? And so all the funding is shifting. Our health care is shifting. Large companies are gearing up for whatever. I've seen more guards in front of banks than I've ever seen in my life. I just see unrest. I don't see peace. And then I just decided to go back in and say to the younger folk, how do you see peace? How do you see peace?
And have them be thinking about it. So that's the name of the show.
Right.
And so what you are going to be doing then going forward is what?
What I'm going forward is starting in September, the new school year. I've already got it in framework. I'm working with 300 teachers in the state of Oregon, and we are working on tools to be able to help students through art to communicate frustration so that they can be peaceful during their classrooms, because schools should be safe, period.
This kind of really harkens back to your father, Charles, what you know, how he worked his art.
He actually ended up teaching. He opened up several small schools to teach people to be individuals rather than commercial artists, to speak their own truth. And that's what I'm trying to do with his art, is to say, here is a man who spoke his own truth. No one else did this like this.
To find a door that can open your mind, but in any case, a very well-rounded and thoughtful education. It's a challenge.
It is a challenge. 6 years ago, when I started speaking to a lot of these smaller grassroots schools, they're still standing strong, and they're bringing in other teachers to say, don't believe the person behind the curtain.
Right.
Because the curtain is unfortunately covering up so many mistakes that even Portland Public Schools has made, and it's starting to come out. We're not handling our money well, so they attack, the first thing they attack is our music departments, our art departments. And when I started my foundation, I literally would go into schools and walk into classrooms where all their music and art instruments were locked up in cabinets. The rooms were empty because they didn't have teachers to teach it.
Yeah.
That's because there wasn't money to manage all that area.
Let me move on from that important work you're doing to some of the things that are integral, sounds to me, to the Q Center. Portland Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, what's that about?
The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence is a national organization.
What a great name, by the way.
Yes.
I don't even know what it means.
They're this wonderful group of people who dress up as nuns. They do their faces up basically as a disguise so you don't see the real person. And they literally take over cities to make sure that people are loved and cared for. And they go to events and just walk around in their beautiful entourage with this beautiful, peaceful elegance. And then they bring love and joy into people's hearts without any malice whatsoever. But they do these events and raise money, and then they donate it to organizations like the Cerndorf Foundation and the Q Center in order for us to continue to do our work.
By paying it forward, yeah.
Paying it forward. Yeah. And most of the people who are sisters in Portland are very, very influential people, which we can't name names because that's part of their anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
But they're incredible human beings. You know, I'm very rogue in my foundation. I'm a 501c3, but I'm very rogue. And I don't take money from any type of organization that does not support the LGBTQ community. Partly because that's where I learned my bullying from. Secondly, Portland used to be the weird capital of Oregon. Unfortunately, it's gentrified.
Word?
Thank you. And that's what's keeping me into the peace cycle 2017-2018.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lodging myself into three schools, Roosevelt High and two elementary schools in St. John's. And I'm bringing seniors from the Rainbow Art Project that I started.
I was just going to ask you about the Rainbow Art Project.
5 years ago, I made a documentary, and I interviewed senior LGBTQ members and what they think they should say to students. And it worked so well that now I'm taking them into the school to actually have one-on-one conversations.
Yeah.
Think how powerful it is to bring in some seniors, mm-hmm. sit down with some students who are 6 and 7 years old, and they say, I have two mommies, or I have two fathers. And to be able to hear, that's great, that's wonderful,
yeah.
because there's still an oppression in the midst. That's not a healthy lifestyle, and it is.
How best to get to know the work these organizations and causes do? What do you suggest people do who aren't familiar with those communities?
And I wish I had those answers. And the reason why I say that is because I belong to about 15 groups right now, women of all colors, trying to bridge that gap, trying to make it simpler to understand culture, to understand what it's like to just sit and have a beer with somebody and not be afraid. Part of being in the closet all my life made it real easy for me. One of my favorite stories is being a woman in an all-male sales force in Atlanta, Georgia, at a sales meeting, and I was sitting down in front, and everybody thought I was somebody's secretary. So during that time, people would walk up to me, men, and saying, "What are you going to do tonight?" And I could tell it was an innuendo. So I said, "My room's 109. Come up at 8 o'clock. And I'd wink at him. And then another man would come and ask me what I was doing tonight. And I said, "My room is 109. Come on up." Well, by 8 o'clock comes along, outside my door are five men standing there looking
story.
At each other. And I swing open my door. I have my Levi's and my Pendleton wool shirt on and a cigar in my hand. I said, "Great, let's play poker." And it broke the ice so much that every single one of these guys came inside. We sat down. We talked about what it was like to be gay, what it was like to be lesbian. And they shared knowing people and thought, "Wow, this is really informative. Thank you." And this was back in the 80s.
Wow, that's a great story.
I think about that, and I use that in my heart all the time, because if I can be just genuinely me, which I think we all, especially in the arts, we are genuinely ourselves. And that's why we get away with so much, is because people look at you and say, "Did you really say that?" And I, "Yes, I did." And I meant it. And being in with students, part of our 2-week course is I say to them, "You're free to say anything you want. You just can't be disrespectful."
Yes.
These kids hold the disrespect to almost a zero. But they let their language fly, and I don't react to it.
Yeah.
Because it's the reaction to the negative, what we think is negative, that makes them want to do it more.
Yeah.
You know, I joke because I used to say to my girlfriends, "Oh, I'm sorry you're straight." And I don't even think about it anymore, because now it's just like, you're you, I'm me. Let's leave the bedroom out of it and just be friends. And
yeah.
That's what it's really about. And if kids can grow up thinking about that and respect each one's gender identity, then we'll be fine. But
yeah.
We have to get it there at a young age.
You have to cultivate respect for each other and love for yourself.
Right. And another answer to your question about how do you get people who are questioning about a community as such as the LGBTQ or the Black community or whatever community, I just finished watching one of the best documentaries at the Queer Doc, which is an annual documentary show at the Hollywood Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Conversations with Elders. And it was a 1-hour conversation with one of our wonderful Portland residents, who's the father of Pink Martini, Thomas Lauderdale. It was his father. And his father has been gay all his life. And Thomas was adopted along with 3 other kids. The whole story was phenomenal, but it made me have a feeling that I hadn't felt in a long time, and that's how important it is to share, just share.
So I think that is to have respect for yourself, self-love, and love for others.
Exactly. So simple, but it's again, peace is simple. Just don't do it. Don't hate. But that takes us forever.
It's a learned mechanism, isn't it?
It is.
Thank you for teaching that.
Thank you for letting me be here with you right now.
That was Anessa Anderson speaking with Cindy Cerndorf of the Charles Cerndorf II Art Foundation. Learn more about the organization's work in the community by visiting cerndorf2artfoundation.org or visit our show page at kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living. You can access that link along with some other resources. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. We're going to close out with a piece by local musician Deborah Giannini. She offers some thoughts about a timely topic or two with a song by Aeneas Mitchell. It's called One Good Thing. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.
I'm Deborah Giannini, and I'm a neo-folk musician. That means that you're much more likely to hear songs from me that are contemporary, written about the times that we live in. There's a lot of great music in the legacy and traditions of folk music, but there are great artists writing good songs today. I'm going to profile one. Her name is Aeneas Mitchell. She is a great poet and also the sweetest badass that I know. She's applied her creativity to the stage in musical form through a folk opera called Hadestown, and in many ways, including a song for that production that she wrote called The Wall. She's been prophetic. But I'm going to pull one out from her second professional recording called Hymns for the Exiled. And the name of this song is One Good Thing. Seems fitting for many of us living in America today to be reminded that even in hard times, that our art, our culture, the creativity of our people will see us through. This is One Good Thing by Aeneas Mitchell. My country, tell me one good thing. Cash and Elvis, Cain and Abel, down in Memphis, trading hands. Big girls are dancing on the tables, dancing for the band. Baby, I'm so low, I don't even see. Tell me something about my country. Tell me one good thing. King and Malcolm, Lamb and Lion.
And that's it for The Politics of Living for this morning. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show will bring you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. And for now, it's just 10 o'clock, and it's time after this announcement for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia.
KBU at the Clinton in our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater will screen two films directed by Les Blank this month, Chulas Fronteras and Del Mero Corazon. On Thursday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Del Mero Corazon is a documentary on Chicano culture in America as it is expressed through music, focusing primarily on the Norteño sounds, featuring performances and interviews from Lil Joe and La Familia, Leo Garza, and more. Chulas Fronteras is a documentary about the music of the Mexican community on both sides of the Texas-Mexico border, particularly of migrant farmers. It includes materials about the roots of the music, but devotes principal attention to the music as a protest against oppression and racism. Again, these films will screen Thursday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street